Culture and Outdoor Resources Committee will come to order. 6:42, 43. Auditor Nobles, Ms. Boss, is here to give the evaluation report on public libraries, which we requested, and we appreciate very much your research and welcome you to come and tell us about it and reveal it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and with me at the table is Joe Voss, who was the manager of this evaluation. Madam Chair and members, I think most people have very fond feelings about public libraries. Most people probably start using public libraries early in life for summer reading and school projects and continue on for many years. I know I certainly continue to visit my public libraries in St. Paul, and whenever I'm there, the place is just bustling with all kinds of people, many different age groups and walks of life. But little did I know, Madam Chair, that there were controversies lurking in the shadows of our public library system until you requested an evaluation by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. So it has certainly been enlightening to me, and I think to the rest of the staff, to better understand what is essentially a local public service, but one that the state really has a significant impact on. So thank you, Madam Chair, for your request. I hope that you and the members of this committee and other legislators that are interested will find it useful as you continue to look at public libraries as an important cultural resource for this state. So thank you, and with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to ask Ms. Voss to briefly present the highlights of our report. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Voss, and welcome to the committee again, and we appreciate your ability to be fluid with our schedule.
Okay. Well, thank you, Representative Murphy and committee members. For the record, my name is Jill Voss, and I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office, and I'm here to present our public libraries evaluation. Before I start, I do want to introduce the other member of our team, Tim Bennett, also worked on this evaluation. We focused on two major topics, public library organization and funding. And for the most part, our conclusions are rather positive. In terms of organization, we found that Minnesota uses a complex, multi-layered approach to ensure that residents have access to library services. And for the most part, it's working pretty well. Local governments are responsible for funding and operating public libraries, and the state's responsible for providing an umbrella of programs and funding to regionally based systems of libraries, not individual libraries. In terms of funding, it's largely a local government responsibility. At the same time, the state does mandate that local governments spend a minimum amount of money for library services, and we found wide variations in what local governments have to spend.
Excuse me, Ms. Voss. When you talk about local government, are you talking community or county or city or?
Representative Murphy, members, I'm talking cities and counties. We have some recommendations, but we don't call for major changes in either the structure or the funding of public libraries. And so let me start by just kind of providing a little bit of background information. First of all, what are public libraries? By law, public libraries have to provide all residents of a city or county with free access to information. Public libraries also have to receive at least half of their funding from public funds. Public libraries are more than just buildings that people visit to check out books. Today's public library is really a virtual environment that allows users to access library materials worldwide from their home computers, from their office computers, and from their school computers 24 hours a day. Libraries also provide a whole host of programs and materials to promote literacy and to encourage lifelong learning. And public libraries also serve as sites for community meetings, as well as just general informal spots that residents like to meet and gather at. But public libraries are facing some major challenges. Technological advances coupled with an increased demand for services, staff cuts, a more diverse population to serve, and a generally poor economy have all made it difficult for libraries to maintain their level of services. Okay, so now I'm kind of really getting into the findings here. So let's talk about this multi-layered system of public libraries. We'll start at the bottom. State law allows any city, county, or group of cities and counties to band together to establish and operate a public library. In 2008, 138 cities, counties, and regional entities, or groups of local governments, operated libraries. They operated 135 public libraries that consisted of 359 library buildings throughout the state. And on page 13 of our report, we have a map that shows hopefully 359 dots where all of the public library buildings are located. About half of the state's public libraries were operated by local governments with less than 5,000 residents. Libraries ranged in size from the McKinley Public Library in northeastern Minnesota, which serves about 80 residents and spends about $8,000 a year, all the way up to the Hennepin County Library, which serves 1.1 million residents and has a budget of about $67 million. So there's a broad range of libraries in there. Resting on top of this layer of local libraries is a state network of 12 regional public library systems. And we also have a map of these systems in our report. They're on page 17. The goal of these regional systems is to help local governments provide library services as efficiently as possible. For the most part, all counties and all cities that choose to operate libraries must be members of their public library, regional public library system. The systems are set up via joint powers arrangements among local governments, and local governments actually oversee the operation of the regional public libraries. There are basically two types of regional public library systems. Six of the 12 systems are federated systems, where local governments operate the libraries in the area, and the regional public library system provides services to all of the member libraries. The other six regional systems are considered consolidated, and this is where the regional library system actually operates one library in the region for all of their members. An example of a consolidated region would be Great River Regional Library in St. Cloud, in the St. Cloud area. Great River operates one library with 32 buildings for the entire six county area. And finally, regional public library systems are funded with a combination of state and local government funding, mostly local government funding. In addition to the regional public library systems, we have multi-type library cooperation systems. There are seven of these, and we have a map again. Page 21 shows you the seven multi-type systems that also cover the state. The goal of the multi-types is to increase cooperation among the different types of libraries, among academic, school, public, and special libraries. Unlike the regional public library systems, which are organizations of local government, the multi-type systems are organizations of libraries. Each has its own governing board that pretty much helps the multi-type define its role, and the governing board oversees its operation. Unlike the regional library systems, the multi-type systems are almost entirely funded by state dollars. Okay, at the top of our system, our multi-layered system, is State Library Services in the Minnesota Department of Education. It's Minnesota's lead library agency. And one of the major goals of State Library Services is to ensure that all residents have access to library services. This is an important role, but it's largely administrative and kind of behind the scenes. State Library Services does not provide public library services. It does not fund individual libraries out there, nor does it monitor or regulate individual public libraries. Instead, it provides funding to regionally based systems to make sure that residents have access to a basic set of services. Minitex also provides funds to Minitex to actually deliver some programs to the regional library systems. Minitex is a joint venture of the Office of Higher Education in the University of Minnesota. So that's sort of the overall organization of public libraries. And so, does it work? We think the answer is, for the most part, yes. We think that the regional public library system is working pretty well. Although the regional library systems vary widely in how they are organized and the array of services that they provide, we found that regional libraries have been effective in sharing resources among their member libraries, providing a basic core of services that I've got listed, shown on the monitors, and in expanding what libraries are able to offer the residents. And many regional public library systems go above and beyond the basics. And this depends on the needs and the desires of local governments, because they dictate what the regional library systems provide. We, as part of our evaluation, we surveyed all of the public library directors in the state, and the overwhelming majority of public library directors felt that the advantages of belonging to a regional public library system outweighed any disadvantages, and there are some disadvantages. They felt that their particular regional public library system did meet their needs and was a good fit. And they felt that their libraries realized both financial and programmatic benefits from participating. So they got a pretty good report card from the public library directors. We think that the multi-type systems have been less successful. First of all, I'd like to emphasize that they do have a huge task. On average, each system receives about $200,000. Each multi-type system has about one to two staff, and they have huge geographic areas that they have to cover. Some multi-type systems cover more than 20,000 square miles, and with a couple of 100 different types of libraries in their area to serve. So they've got a huge clientele. One of our concerns about the multi-type system is that statutes do not clearly delineate what services multi-types have to perform or have to deliver. And so they vary quite a bit in terms of what they do and who they serve. some of what they do, especially in the areas of sharing resources and developing delivery and reference services and providing databases in their geographic areas, actually duplicates or overlaps with activities of other entities, namely Minitex and the public regional public library systems. Only about a third of the public library directors that we surveyed thought that their library benefited from participating in a multi-site system. And many of the regional public library system directors that we talked with felt that the multi-site systems provided few services for the public libraries in their area. Our final observation about the overall organization of public library services involves the library community's perception of state library services. We heard a lot of negative comments about state library services. Many in the library community want a more visible and active state library agency. In a way, they want state library services to play a role that's somewhat beyond that which is laid out for the agency in statutes. Part of the discontent is due to the fact that the organizational structure has state library services working through regional library systems instead of individual public libraries out there. Finally, we also found that some of the disconnect between state library services activities and the library community's expectations is somewhat fueled by an agenda that state library services has adopted for itself that it's been largely unable to fulfill over the last several years. So where does this leave us in terms of organization? Well, our first recommendation is for the legislature to eliminate the multi-type library cooperation systems and move their function and funding to the regional public library systems. Two of the multi-type systems have already sort of unofficially merged with the regional public library system in their area, and we think that this should continue to happen with legislative prodding. To help increase state library services visibility and advocacy, we also recommend that the legislature require state library services to issue a biennial library report to the appropriate legislative committee by January 1st of each odd-numbered year. We also recommend that state library services become more visible and useful by working more closely with the regional public library system to help address some of the critical issues that libraries are facing. For example, we think that state library services could be looking at developing some best practices to help libraries address some of the funding issues that they're facing. And now I'd like to shift gears just a little bit and talk about funding, our second major area. In 2008, public library revenue came to just over $207 million. Most of this money, about $175 million, comes from local governments. Counties provided about $102 million, and cities provided about $73 million. As you can see from the pie chart, the state contributed only about 7% of public library revenue, and the federal role is almost non-existent. I'd like to zoom in just a little bit now and look more closely at what drives the local government portion of public library revenue. I mentioned earlier that Minnesota has maintenance of effort requirements that dictate what local governments must, at a minimum, contribute for library services. State law requires that all counties and all cities that operate public libraries to provide a minimum level of funding for their libraries, for libraries and library services. Now, statutes lay out kind of a complicated formula, and I've sort of simplified it a great deal for this slide, but maintenance of effort requirements are based on either a local government's adjusted net tax capacity, or I just like to say property values, or its population, whichever is less. Or for those counties and cities that pay more than this very minimum amount, their maintenance of effort requirement is based on what they've spent in previous years. So how does this play out in reality? Well, what local governments contribute varies widely. In 2008, cities that operated public libraries had to pay $38 per resident for library services, while counties contributed $16. City requirements ranged from about $10 per resident in Brainerd to just under $113 per resident in McKinley. County requirements ranged from about $5 per resident in Rousseau County to more than $49 per resident in Hennepin County. We also found that about a third of the counties pay at the very minimum mandated amount, which is about $13 per resident. Their maintenance of effort is based on either their property value or the size of their population. The cities that operate libraries generally had to pay more than the counties in which they were located. And this is a sore point for many city libraries that serve large numbers of county residents, because they generally don't receive any funds from the county to do this. For example, cities that operated libraries in St. Louis County paid anywhere from $24 to $100 more per resident for library services than St. Louis County did. Finally, I think it's important to note that local governments generally provide more than what maintenance of effort requirements actually require them to pay. According to data collected by the State Library Services, local governments contributed on average about 13% more than they were required to pay each year between 1994 and 2007. And it looks like in preliminary data for 2008 would suggest that local governments are ending up paying about 7% more than their maintenance of effort requirements would require. And that, committee, is the extent of my remarks. In summary, I'd just like to kind of hit the major points again. Local governments primarily responsible for funding and operating public libraries. The state primarily responsible for providing sort of an umbrella of services and programs to regionally based systems. And our major recommendation for the legislature is to move the function and funding for multi-type library cooperation systems, move that responsibility over to the regional public library system. And that is it. So if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Ms. Voss. We might ask for some clarifying questions. I intend to do similarly with what we did with the land audit and DNR, is that we will submit some written questions and ask you to come back at a later time to answer those written questions. But initially, we might have a few. Like, for instance, okay, the people that are employed by the regional libraries, who are they employees of?
Representative Murphy, committee. Regional public library employees are employees of the regional public library system. They are overseen by the Director of Public of the Regional Systems is actually appointed by the local government, by their Board of Directors. In a consolidated system, all of the employees in the library system are employees of the regional public library system. So all library employees.
So is that of the counties then, or the cities, or the library system as a whole?
It depends, Representative Murphy, who employs library employees depends on how the individual library system is organized.
With the joint powers agreement.
With the joint powers agreements. If a city in federated systems, if employees of the individual libraries, the employee, Hennepin County Library, McKinley Public Library, those employees are all employees of either a county or a city. In a federated system, such as the Great River system, with libraries in St. Cloud and Albany, the people who work there are employees of the Great River regional system. So it depends on how the system is organized. It's a local government prerogative.
Okay. But they wouldn't be state employees in any case?
In any case, they are not state employees.
Okay. Are the multi-library system state employees?
No, they are also employees of the multi-type system. And they are all employees of the system rather than any local governments.
And is the Minitex system, are they the employees of the Minitex system state employees?
Yes.
Okay. They are. And the people that work for state library services are state employees.
Yes.
Thank you. The federal money that's almost non-existent, $0.56 million, is it that the federal government doesn't fund libraries very much, or is it they fund services within library systems, perhaps, or two libraries, or is it that we are not going after the federal dollars?
Representative Murphy, committee, it's a little bit of both. Not that we're not going after the dollars, it's a little bit of both that the federal government doesn't provide a lot of money, and the money that they do provide does not always get down to the public library system as we've described it. Actually, the federal government in total provides about $3 million to the state of Minnesota, to state library services. And some of that money, around a half a million or so, goes to the various regional public library systems. Not all of them get money, but some of them do. The rest of the money, state library services uses to give a portion to Minitex to provide interlibrary loan services, to provide delivery services and things. And state library services also uses a portion of their federal funds to fund statewide projects like the Minneapolis Tribune project, which is trying to take all of the old newspapers and put them online. And a lot of statewide things that public libraries can access, but they never really see the money for anything. So the money in the pie chart is basically what public libraries actually see.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The recommendation relative to multi-type library cooperation systems, observe on page 68 that some of them have unofficially merged with their regional public library systems. Is there an encouragement we could make in that direction, an incentive as a more natural way to phase it out?
Ms. Voss.
Representative Murphy, Representative Hausman. They've been able to merge for years, and most of them never have. There's a provision in statute that does allow them to use the same local governing board for both of the systems. And although some of them, some of the regionals and the multi-types actually used the same board years ago, they got away from that completely. And so there isn't a great, we didn't notice in a great deal of cooperation among the systems in some parts of the state. So I think they probably need something a little stronger than, please.
Anything else at this time? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will be in touch.
Thank you.
Ms. Klinzing, Commissioner? You have received the report earlier than we did, and you are acknowledging some things. Do you want to quickly report to us? And then we will, when we have them back, we will also have you back.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Karen Klinzing. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Education. And actually, we do have a division within the department that is the State Library Services division that's referenced here multiple times in this report. What we're going to do is just respond really to the recommendations that have been made. But just to mention one thing with respect to Representative Hausman's question about the multi-types and an encouragement, one of the things we have noted about the two regions that have merged with the multi-types is that in those regions in particular, the boundaries are very similar between the region that was being served and the multi-type that was in existence. So I think some of the other areas in the state that is not as obvious and not as those geographic boundaries are not as similar. And so that may be part of why it hasn't happened as easily in some areas of the state as it has in others. It's just one reason, but it's something that I thought maybe should be brought up. There are four recommendations that are made by the Office of Legislative Auditor. The first one being to reduce duplication, enhance coordination. The legislature should eliminate multi-county, multi-type library systems and move their function and funding to the regional public library systems. We concur with the recommendation regarding these systems, and the goals and priorities currently charged to the multi-type systems could be integrated into these regional public library systems and be able to transform them into some regional library systems that work with all types of libraries within those respective regions. And we would be willing to, you know, work with the legislature, but it would require more than just a state agency action. It would be something that would require us to work with you on that. Secondly, the second recommendation, the state library services should work more closely with regional public library systems to help identify and address critical needs and issues that have statewide implications. State library services will continue to work closely with regional public library systems and the respective numbers, member counties and cities, and other library stakeholders on these issues. And we're taking to heart some of the recommendations in this report and some of the valuable feedback we were able to get through the survey that OLA conducted, and we'll try to improve upon our working closely with those different regions. In trying to coalesce that into what would be recommendation three, which is a recommendation that we, at the state level, publish a biennial report. And I would think that that report would be a report that would bring to the fore some of the issues and other goals that would be found in working with the regional library systems in recommendation two. Of course, recommendation three, the biennial reports that we sometimes bring to the legislature, not always an easy thing to put together, but it is something that, because libraries are important to the commissioner, she wanted to go ahead and commit our staff to doing that biennial report. And then fourth, that the State Library Services should develop a process to verify local government spending for maintenance of effort certification using the best data available from the State Auditor's Office and the Department of Education's annual public library survey. Again, you know, testimony to why the OLA reports can be helpful. It did uncover within the State Library Services Division some more data that they could use at the State Auditor's Office, State Auditor's site that they weren't aware of. It doesn't really affect how much money would flow to the regions, but it does affect some of the analysis that we're able to do. So certainly we're going to be using this other data available at the State Auditor's Office and take that recommendation hard as well.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Ms. Voss, can you share at a later time the survey with us?
Certainly.
And the results? Or at least the questions that were asked? Or is that Auditor Nobles?
Madam Chair, we will do that.
Thank you.
We will just check on our offer of confidentiality. Sometimes to get on an individual basis the most candid responses, there is an expectation that we would not reveal individual responses, but we can certainly aggregate those for you in a way that I think would still be meaningful.
We'd appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any additional comments tonight on public libraries? Then, second item, the evaluation report from the natural resource land report. And we submitted to the Department of Natural Resources and Bowser and others that were interested a list of questions that were submitted by you committee members individually, as well as through the discussion that took place in the committee meeting. And I kind of grouped them, reworded them a little bit, and grouped them, and asked for responses from the commissioner or the assistant commissioner of natural resources or whoever else they wanted to designate, and from Bowser, and also some people from the public said that they wanted to respond also. So now is the time. DNR? Commissioner Holston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mark Holston, Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources.
Thank you for coming.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, how would you like me to proceed?
How would you like to do it?
Well, it was about 2 weeks ago you had a presentation by the legislative auditor presenting the report. I've got a list of questions.
And last Tuesday, I think we submitted the questions to you or to your agency. Mm-hmm. And to give you time to so you wouldn't be caught off guard by any questions or whatever, and answer completely, that kind of thing. We were particularly interested in easements, and we were interested in what's going to happen and the long-term needs of the department.
Madam Chair, maybe I should start by saying, let me just reference the report a little bit, because I've had an opportunity to hear, see newspaper accounting of what the report is supposed to say. I've heard members make reference to the report over the last couple of weeks. And I think people, if they have the report, if they could just look at the summary page in the front and the findings, we can go through some of those details of what the report actually says or doesn't say, and get into some of the questions and answers by the Department of Natural Resources, both to the report and to the committee. I think it's important to point out, as some people have articulated, that this report says that the Department of Natural Resources doesn't have the necessary funding to manage the existing lands. Well, actually, that's not what the report says. The report actually points out or asks the question. It says it appears that the department does not have the adequate resources. It begs the question. It asks the legislature to do a little bit more in-depth look and analysis of the management of those lands, and really puts it back to you and to us to be able to answer those questions more thoroughly. It's not an indictment, because quite frankly, this is as we point out in our response to the legislative auditor, land management isn't a program. The auditor didn't go out onto the landscape and look at the physical structure of the land and the physical characteristics of that land and measure management. It did a paper analysis of what management is or is not, and asks a lot of questions. And that's good and that's helpful, and one that we're able to walk through, but I want to be clear. This is a paper analysis. It's not a physical, on-the-ground inspection of what management is or isn't. And it asks the questions, do we have enough resources? And we can get into some of those details later. It also points out that we should be doing some more long-range budget analysis and planning. And we're doing many of those things, but the report really breaks out. You have to understand that the DNR is doing a lot of diversified activities. Our scope is very broad. From the physical management and things that you are very accustomed of state government coming in and talking about, facilities, roads, bridges, trails, buildings, we have that laundry list of those items, and the report points out we've got those reports, we've got that analysis. That's very easy for us to do. But then you have the physical land management, which is much more arbitrary, and we need to get more down into the details of what is it that you are truly looking for. Are we talking about natural resource management in a park? Are we talking about it in an SNA? Are we talking about it in the forest? Are we talking about the separation between forest land and school trust fund lands? Are we talking about wildlife management lands? You start to see the myriad of different management plans that we had in front of us and that scope and responsibility. When we start talking about budget analysis, you know, many of our management of our lands are done on a commercial basis, where those lands are managed through commercial timber harvest. There isn't a lot of additional costs that go into that, or that cost is an ongoing process, and many of that management activities are directly related to the commercial revenues that they're able to generate. Many of the management plans, and we can talk about that later, are much more in a state of flux, where we've gone from very expensive management programs to ones that are now trying to utilize more cooperation, more contracting. Also, expanding our commercial opportunities on wildlife management areas to, one, provide that physical land management, but also at the same time provide that necessary natural resource management activities. The report points out many of the things that we're currently doing and tells us to continue to do, like asset management. Manage our land such as assets. Sell off the lands that we don't need or no longer meet our management resource needs, and convert those assets into new assets of higher priority, more focused approaches. It tells us to continue to do the county outreach that we've begun, working with specific counties, trying to do a county basis we did a pilot program in Roseau County where we actually look at land as an asset with the county and talk about exchanging, selling, acquisition with that county so that we can have a better understanding of that landscape with that local unit of government. we're going to take that out on a broader scale once we work through the bubbles. And the report points out that we should continue to do those types of things. There's a lot of things in this report that are good, and we're more than happy to engage in and talk with you. And it points out many of the things that we are doing. As we talked about easements here briefly before in Representative Wagenius's committee earlier, a week or two ago, where we were able to talk more in depth about easements, we are moving forward. That was an item that we identified problems in easements. Easements, we have a laundry list of easements that we have utilized over the years. Many we no longer are actively engaged in terms of acquiring new, but we're also looking to expand that opportunity. Easements, however, on the conservation front are relatively a new phenomenon. The national standard just came into effect in 2004. So we are now developing and are in the process of developing, with the help of the legislature, as we brought this for the issues before you many years ago, as we start to develop the criteria, start to develop the management plans associated with the management and ongoing management and monitoring of easements. That is all being laid out and being developed and will be implemented sometime this year. So we're addressing many of those issues that the report brought out. And Chair, do you want to get into some of the specifics? Do you want to have members pick out specific questions, or do you just want to go through the list?
You started to address the findings and the recommendations. And are there, one of the questions was, are there any of the recommendations that you don't think that you'll be able to accomplish?
That we could not accomplish?
Yeah.
No, we can accomplish.
Or that will not be achievable, I guess that's the term.
Achievable. No, I think everything that, if you look at the back, our agency's response, we went through the 10 items that were specific to the Department of Natural Resources. And we agree and we'll be implementing 8 of those. The 9th is one that we partially agree with and will comply with. There are some nuances to item 9 that we can talk about, and I think I've touched on some of those items we can get into a little bit more deeper. And 10 follows in that same, where we don't see that approach as being helpful on a parcel-by-parcel basis, but we can get into those details. But any of the recommendations that were made by the auditor, we don't see any significant issue or concerns in implementing those recommendations.
And I think one of the things on the easements that are acquisitions had to do with the outcomes also. Do you see yourself developing outcomes for what you're going?
We already have outcomes. We already have criteria. When we are buying or developing a WMA, we have both statutory criteria, and then we also overlay internally criteria for us to best maximize, focus our resources, or the resources that you provide us with for those acquisitions. We're not just out on that landscape buying whatever comes available. We do have priority lists. We do have criteria that have been developed, and we use those in our biennial acquisition plans. Every biennium inside the DNR, we set out a criteria. We set out our acquisition plans, and we try to follow those plans. And we follow them based upon the criteria that we've developed. And I want to assure the members that we haven't made an acquisition in the last 10 years or received a donation where those lands have come into the department where the costs haven't been identified to bringing those lands up to a minimum standard. They are either been identified and brought, or they are brought up to a minimum standard before they're even brought into the agency. That is something that we've implemented over 10 years ago and something that we continue to do today. We hold these lands to a standard, and we try to manage them to that level.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to clear a couple clarifications here, Madam Chair, on six of the questions, it was suggested during the interim. I've always understood the interim to be the year after the first year the legislature met, not, I call this the election year, the fun year.
Put it on down to election year then.
Election year. Seven, I'm kind of confused here because, and I heard Commissioner Holston use the words comply with, and just the way that's worded, the OLA made 13 recommendations. When will the DNR adopt the recommendations? I guess I'm kind of curious, since when does the OLA have anything to do with the telling the DNR to do anything or any state agency or group to do anything? When will the DNR adopt the recommendations? Who cares what the legislative auditor says? I mean, if you think about it, who cares?
I do.
Oh, you do? I don't. I've always asked the question, who audits the legislative auditor? And Will said he did, so I think we're okay probably there. But with that being said, it looks to me like this legislative committee or this legislature is giving the OLA a lot of power they don't have, because I don't know where the OLA has any power to have any state agency do anything. Like I've said, I've seen some of the reports that are just garbage, and I don't know why we would say in this question, when will the DNR adopt the recommendations? Are there any recommendations that will not be achievable? Well, who cares? I think if you, Madam Chair, say the DNR better do something, I think we got some serious talking to do. But I don't understand why we would ask when they will adopt their recommendations. Maybe this committee doesn't like their recommendations. Am I missing something here?
No, but probably the question was not worded absolutely properly. Perhaps the legislature puts legislation in action that asks you to do it. Certainly they will. But I think we were more interested in what I gathered from the discussion that night, or that afternoon, or whenever it was we were having the discussion, was that we were wondering if the department had any problems with any of the recommendations that the auditor was suggesting.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And the commissioner made me nervous when he said complying with the OLA. I mean, who cares about the OLA? I care about the legislature, this committee. You better be right. Complying with that stuff. But as far as the legislative auditor, big deal.
Certainly it would be our responsibility to put the order out. Yes.
Well,
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Davids, I did technically misspeak. We are not trying to come in compliance with the legislative audit report, especially this particular report. That was a wrong use of terminology. Not that I need to defend the legislative auditor, but they are a branch of the legislative branch of government, and they are your tool to oversee the executive branch and make sure that it is following and complying with the rules and regulations and laws and programs and stuff you guys generate on a daily basis. But we have no problem with disagreeing with the legislative auditor when that's appropriate. In this particular report, I will tell you, it is it's a very simple analysis, and the items that I talked about earlier, these are things that we are already doing or are in the process of doing, the ones that we said that we agree with and will try to implement or are in the process of implementing.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Holst, if you're already doing them, why is the legislator auditor asking you to do them?
Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
Representative Davids, I think what the legislative auditor was pointing out is that the agency is in the process of doing many of these things. Some of the items they asked us to formalize from memorandums where we have gone into the agency and said, agency, when we are acquiring with third parties, we shall do it this way. There's a more formal way of implementing that through an operational order. They make that type of recommendation. The auditor is trying to answer a very broad and generic question that you asked him to do. The scope that the audit commission gave the auditor was, quite frankly, too broad. And the auditor tried to find out points and pieces that he thought, not to speak for him, but I am, I'm sorry, that you were looking for and were interested.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hausman, to this point?
Well, I was just generally to the broad question.
Okay. I don't want to speak for you.
The broad question of the role this plays, and the way I would see it is that it's the legislative auditor. They report to us, and then we sort through recommendations. And the one that sort of jumps out at me is the one that has been sort of an ongoing undercurrent this whole legislative session, and that has to do with what's the right thing to do about acquisition. And what I've observed is there are really two points of view, and citizen groups more often, I think, have had a desire to continue to pursue strategic acquisition. And the legislature has started maybe getting a little more nervous about that, asking the question, can we afford to manage what we've got? And that seems to be a legitimate question for a legislature who's charged with a budget to ask. How much can we afford? What ought we to be doing? And so from that perspective, I think it gives us helpful observations about that thing that we're wrestling with. I think citizen groups don't often, they don't have the budget responsibility we have, and so they would view acquisition from a different perspective, I think, than we do. The specific question that I would be curious about in terms of the department's advice that they might give, and it was just a footnote relative to Vermilion, the sort of special PILT arrangement that had been built in for the Vermilion purchase, but then more broadly, the finding that the counties were really receiving more in PILT than they would have from property taxes were those lands still on the property tax rolls. Do you have any observation or advice about that specific issue?
Madam Chair, Representative Hausman, no, we do not.
Representative Guinness.
Well, I have a couple of questions. More getting at the strategic acquisition question. It was observed up in question one that Bowser ranks proposals and then has certain criteria and measures what it does against those criteria. And I'm hearing that you have something similar, but I'm going to help me how you apply that. And here's what I'm thinking about. In the LCCMR bill, before Representative Rukavina put up an amendment and it was amended, there was two distinctly different acquisitions. One was to buy land that the Parks and Trails Council had purchased on the state's behalf and assuming that we were going to purchase it. Okay. And he said, no, we're not going to do that. So I want to talk about the relationship of you to the Parks and Trails Council. That's one issue. But then the second part of was money for, so those were very specific parcels of land. The second piece of the acquisition puzzle was money for a couple of groups, I think Nature Conservancy and Trust for Public Land, and they were more general pots of money. How do you rank both of those pots of money? I mean, how do you make a determination in your relationship with the Parks and Trails Council And then how do you make, what's your relationship and your ranking, how do you do it with regard to Trust for Public Land Nature Conservancy as they purchase half of the state and then say now state must purchase?
And members,
Commissioner,
Madam Chair, members, you know, Representative Wagenius is hitting on one of the more complicated issues within the legislature in terms of budgeting for the Department of Natural Resources. The breadth and scope of what you ask us to do is so broad that we take those dollars are very, or those programs are very unique and regimented in their own way. So we don't rank the separation between state park acquisition through the monies you give us, because those are dedicated dollars towards a specific purpose, versus the resources you give us to go towards conservation lands. We set up our own criteria based within using the criteria that is provided either through statute or through the legislative appropriations, but then also criteria internally related to those specific dollars. And those dollars could come from a whole laundry list for specific programs. Specific programs could come from those different funding sources. So that's part of the question. Part of the answer is, what is the funding sources? And do those funding sources... No, it gets down to the funding sources. That's how we separate those activities. We don't take, say, game and fish dollars and buy parkland. We don't have that functionality or that ability to cross those dollars. So I'm not, maybe I didn't understand the question.
And Commissioner, and for all the committee members, we have to, Representative Wagenius's questions have to be answered before we go further with and pass or make recommendations on the bills that are coming before us, because we have the constitutional requirement that we don't supplant. And so we have to have an understanding of the answers to the question that Representative Wagenius asked, and also an understanding of how your department does make those purchases or spends the money for the various things.
Well, Madam Chair, as relationship to, in answering the question, I think we had two, if I understand the LCMR bill as it went to the House, you had two different types. You had state park land acquisition. These were in holdings of properties within state park boundaries. The Parks and Trails Council, those parcels came available. The Parks and Trails Council, as a nonprofit organization whose mission is to advance parks and trails throughout the state of Minnesota, took advantage of those opportunities and purchased those lands on behalf of the state, assuming that, or knowing that, those were in holdings and high priority acquisitions for the state, that at some point, I believe they believed they would be compensated, and that's what LCCMR heard and recommended that to the legislature. Other programs that the LCCMR Commission heard were conservation organizations who have banded together for a number of years to go out and carry out the mission of conservation for the state of Minnesota by partnering with the state through the DNR as its fiscal agent. And then we work, to the commission's response, the commission is very intimately active in those specific acquisitions, and we're along with them as a partner in that.
Representative Wagenius.
Okay. We're sort of getting to the question, but let's take the latter first. Set aside the Parks and Trails Council. I mean, my question there would be, how would they know what is high priority? But when you're saying these other groups are carrying out the mission, I want to know more specifically, do you have a list of lands and that you're saying, well, this SNA is really good, because I know you have an SNA list. This AMA, Aquatic Management Area, is really good. It's at the top of the list. Go and look for it. Or are they just going out and looking for lands and coming to you and saying, gee, this looks kind of nifty if you want to buy it? Tell me how this ranking is working.
Commissioner Holston.
Madam Chair, how do we deal with that?
How does the ranking work?
We have targeted areas of the state that we have gone into that, do we want to be a little bit more specific? Are we talking about AMAs, WMAs, forest land? I need to get a little bit more refined there.
Okay. I know you have ranking lists of AMAs, SNAs, scientific and natural resources, WMAs, wildlife management areas. I know you have ranked lists for each of those. And just for the committee's information, there are about $8 million of backlog in the aquatic management areas, about an $8 million backlog in wildlife management areas, and about an $8 million backlog in prairie easements. But there's a $68 million backlog in scientific and natural areas. So, are those the lists that are used when groups go out and purchase land on behalf of the state? Or is there another criteria that we don't know about?
Commissioner Holston.
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius. No, I think you're familiar with the criteria that we use when we work in third-party agreements that lays out criteria. We have our statutory guidance provided by the legislature.
I don't know what criteria you're talking about. I'm sorry.
Well, specifically to WMAs, we have statutory criteria that talks about it either has to contain or have the potential contain high-value wildlife habitat. It has to be sufficient in size to achieve those goals and objectives and provide for public access and use of those lands. Those are all statutory requirements that have been placed in front of us. We have taken that and added to that highest priorities and provided criteria in that allows us to weed out so that we can be more focused on the acquisition that we're looking to have.
Representative Guinness.
I think I'm thick this evening, Madam Chair. I'm trying to get the relationship between the lists that you have mm-hmm. of WMAs, SNAs, yeah. And you've got those lists. I've seen those lists.
Right.
And the things that folks do when they go out and purchase lands on behalf of the state. Do they look at those lists? Do they follow those lists? Or do they just buy stuff that matches some other criteria? And then, so the question becomes, what's the relationship between all this criteria?
Ed, why don't you come down? Madam Chair, I'm going to have Mr. Bogus, who's our Deputy of Fish and Wildlife.
Thank you.
He may be able to provide a little bit more detail to what Representative Wagenius is looking for.
Bogus?
Bogus, B-O-G-G-E-S-S, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Ed Bogus, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife. And to Representative Wagenius, I can speak to the AMA and WMA, the aquatic management areas and wildlife management areas, and we compile lists. The lists that you reference, the $8 million lists or whatever, are just lists kind of existing willing sellers that have been identified. They're not comprehensive lists of needs for WMA or AMA acquisition. But we do share those lists with the NGOs that we're working with. We also evaluate if they identify a potential acquisition. that's not on our list, we review it ahead of time before they put it on their list to see if it meets our criteria. So there is a back and forth that occurs.
Representative Guinness.
Well, how do we make, what if your list has better stuff, willing sellers with better stuff than the ones that they're bringing forward? How do you deal with that?
Mr. Boggess.
Madam Chair and Representative Guinness, we go through a review process with our field staff and central office staff on whatever they're proposing to do that kind of a comparison of what they're coming up with. A lot of what they do acquire is on our list, but you know, sometimes they have different contacts than we do with willing sellers. So we do end up taking some of theirs, but we also end up saying some of them don't fit with our priority list. So it's an iterative process of comparing. As you know, land acquisition is a little bit inexact because we're dealing with willing sellers. So and those available parcels come and go as land is acquired or sold to someone else other than the state. So it's an iterative process where we're evaluating what they're coming up with what's on our list, and ranking according to the criteria that we have.
And Madam Chair, just so the committee knows, with the Lessard Heritage Funds on acquisition for WMAs and AMAs, I personally sign off on each one of the acquisitions. And I will tell you, there have been ones that we have not included in. We do analysis. We do look at what is being presented and make a value decision if it's going to come into the state system or not.
And Commissioner, do we know who the NGOs are on for any particular project or review? Mr. Boggess was talking about the review process. Do we know who the NGO partners are?
Madam Chair, I believe you do.
From the beginning?
Madam Chair, in part of our third-party agreement, that is laid out.
And is that revealed to the public in a transparent way? Or to the legislature?
Well, Madam Chair, I think... Through the activities at the Lessard Council, the activities of the LCCMR, and those resources, absolutely.
And through the ordinary Department of Natural Resources work with the parks, for instance, on the parks and trails, do we know who the partners might be on those? Are they just the association or? Is it association or is it a council?
Parks and Trails.
Yeah.
It's a council.
Okay.
But Madam Chair, I believe you do.
Okay. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, thanks so much for coming out and talk to us tonight. Let me tell you, when I was first assigned to this committee, I knew very little about anything having to do with the DNR and land acquisition and so forth. Great learning experience for me. You made a comment at the beginning of your testimony tonight that you disagreed with the buzz or whatever word you used about the OLA's report, that you didn't think that the report said that the DNR doesn't have enough resources to manage the lands currently in public possession. But it more so asked the question. Let me ask you, if that's the question, particularly in light of Representative Wagenius's line of questioning about your criteria and your priorities and so forth and so on, what is your answer to that question? Does the DNR have enough resources to manage the lands that it's currently responsible for?
Madam Chair,
Commissioner.
Representative Morgan, when we talk about lands, we're talking about those conservation lands. I will tell you this. Our appetite is very large. The mission that has been presented to us and the goals and objectives are aggressive ones. So we can always use more resources than is being provided to us. And we hold those lands to a minimum standards. I would say it's you want to be careful because if I say we have enough in this appetite of the legislature right now in the decision. I mean, you folks have some very difficult decisions that you're facing right now. But for the most part, we take the resources that are provided to us and we make the on-the-ground management decisions that need to be made for both management of that landscape and meeting the goals and objectives for those future, to reach those goals and objectives of conservation of land and water for the state of Minnesota. So it's a real hard question to answer in that when we get appropriated those dollars, we make, when we have the flexibility, we make those management decisions that are necessary within that biennial approach.
Rep. Sen Morgan.
Commissioner Holston, I give you credit for that two-step around the question, and I'm not saying that facetiously. I'm not looking for reasons not to give you more money or to give you less money. I mean, obviously, we are in difficult budget times and so forth and so on. I'm just trying to get a handle on your perspective on the OLA's report, which seemed to me, as someone who's not an expert, to say just that.
Okay.
The DNR does not have the resources it needs to manage the lands it currently owns. In spite of the appetite, in spite of what we or others may ask you to do in the future, it seems to me that that's what the report was saying. You say it was more asking a question.
Yeah. Representative Morgan, let me try it this way. You really have to dissect the goals. And it's within the context of the goals. On conservation lands, we can, in many cases, just step back, and those lands, as they've come into the state, if we've gone out and acquired them, we have brought them to a standard. Those lands can sit in that status for a long, long time. Would we like to go in? Do we have needs to go in and provide more management? Yes. Do they need additional management resources to management of that land? No, because they will provide the water quality, water retention, or habitat development opportunities. They'll provide a minimum standard. Could we always bring them up to a higher standard? That's a question of need and a question of want. So when we start talking about conservation land management, we have to understand we're not talking about a program. For those who are in the farming world, they understand for a farmer, it's inputs in, outputs out within a year. For us, it can be 10 years, it could be 20 years, it could be 50 or 75, where our need to step in and manage that land or do something doesn't occur. So, one of the things I'd like you to do is turn to page 46 of the report. And this highlights, because it lays out a table of management, what they call shortfalls. In the report, it talks about, let me talk about state forest lands. It went to road maintenance. They did a very simple exercise of adding up all the miles, adding in all the bridges and all the maintenance work that would occur, and it came to the conclusions that you would need $8 million of one time to upgrade that forest road system to those standards, and then $400,000 annually. That would be ludicrous for you to appropriate that kind of money from a management perspective. Why? Because it's not a road system about moving people from community to community. It's about providing management access into that forest. We go in and do management activities through this road system over here for a couple of years. We then pull out and then move our resources to this one. We wouldn't want to go in and do the whole forest road system at one time. That's what the report does. It looks at it at a very surface level and doesn't separate needs versus wants, management of that system. It can't.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Holston. Let me ask one further question. As the chair suggested, we have we're going to be having some bills. One bill in particular coming before us, which is going to recommend some more acquisitions. Quite a large chunk of land acquisition. That's just this year. We're going to be having for the next 23 years. Bill coming for us, recommendations from the Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. And I would imagine that in each one of those bills, they're going to do their work, and they do good work, and they're going to do their analysis. And you say that you've signed off on all of those so far, and I think that's great. But I think in each of those bills, there's going to be a recommendation for further land acquisition into the foreseeable future. Does the DNR, particularly in light of an impending deficit in the next biennium, have the resources? Do you believe you will have the resources from your traditional funding sources to manage greater and greater amounts of land from recommendations from the Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council? Or would the DNR recommend that built into those recommendations from the Lasard Sams Council, land management fees come along with those recommendations?
Commissioner Holston.
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, I have to write that question down because it's
Madam Chair, Commissioner, would you like me to ask it again?
No, it's I've been processing the question because it has a long and a short answer, and I'm going to give you the long one first.
All right.
But I want to make sure I get back to your point. Let me start by saying this. We approach our job differently than we did, say, 10 years ago. We approach this as, and look at that land, that landscape out there, as an asset. We currently have $8.5 million worth of conservation land or land available over the counter for sale. We also are also looking continually look across that landscape and evaluate parcel by parcel the values of those lands. And do they provide the natural resource benefit, the water quality benefit, the forestry benefit, the recreational benefit that they were intended to provide? And that will continue on. That is a living, breathing thing. It will not stop. It needs to continue on. So our land sale portfolio, where it's grown to be quite large, largely because we just kind of got through that system a couple years ago, and unfortunately the market's kind of started to go down on some before we got the whole portfolio put together. But we've now got that portfolio together and are going to continue to manage that out over time. We have another quite, I think, aggressive land sale bill in front of the legislature this year. So we're going to continue to evaluate, acquire new, based upon strategic development opportunities, sell off what we don't need or want or meet our needs anymore. So that's going to continue on. Our area of primary interest tends to be in the area of southern, southwestern, western Minnesota, lands that are the opportunity to restore or redevelop those wetland complexes that were once drained. We're currently in that area of the state somewhere managing between 1 and 2% of the landscape. Of that 1 to 2%, over 50% of that is underwater. That's what we're doing, and that's where we're concentrating our resources and acquisition opportunities in that region of the state. And we're doing it now as we've made some very aggressive administrative changes where we are taking two divisions, our Ecological Resources Division and our Waters Division, our ecologists, our Science of Ecology, and our Science of Hydrology, and we're bringing them together, partnering them now then with side-by-side our Fish and Wildlife and our Forestry Division to focus and be able to articulate and bring those sciences together to better prioritize and impact landscapes in a watershed area. Do we have the resources to do that? Yes, we do. We will continue to do that with those resources. We currently build into our acquisition plans, as I said before, we don't bring a property in unless we have identified its management dollars or its development dollars to bring that up to a development standard or manage it at a development standard at its inception. Our management is constantly changing, and we are looking for ways to offset our costs. And we're not just offsetting our costs, but we're also now looking at ways to generate revenue off of those lands. So you go to a WMA in western Minnesota that previously we had to go on that landscape and burn every so many years for management purposes. We are now contracting with local ranchers to bring cattle onto that landscape to graze it. We're using that as a management technique that we didn't do 10 years ago. Well, we did, but we're doing it more aggressively today. We're looking at those landscapes that we never allowed farmers to access before, and we're asking them to hay it and using that grass now that's been hayed for biomass opportunities. We're developing commercial opportunities to assist local farmers, expand their operations, expand their opportunities onto those lands, while at the same time greatly reducing our administrative management costs on those landscapes also. So we're really being aggressive in trying to take advantage of these new markets and new decisions. The management regime and what the auditor asks us to do is to take and build a long-term budget analysis. It's hard to do because we're in such a changing environment, and the opportunities we're exploring are so great for us that I think we're already doing what you're asking us to do. We're building in those costs, we're identifying those opportunities, and our long-term managements are being offset through new opportunities.
Representative Morgan.
That's a question again.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Erdahl. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Answers are embedded within there.
Well, color me thick as well, Representative Bouguinas,
<All right>.
Because
let me try.
I thought the question I asked was, and admittedly, I threw a lot at you information-wise first, but I thought the question I asked was, does the DNR think that in taking these reports and recommendations from the Lessard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council, that we ought to request from them that they build in a land management fee for new acquisitions that they propose? I did hear at the end of your statement that DNR does that through Senator Anderson's committee and Representative Wiginius's committee. And I don't know whether that's true or not. I don't sit on those committees. But would DNR recommend that these land management fees be built into the acquisition costs in the recommendations that we receive from the Lessard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council?
And, Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, maybe I misinterpreted. I, when you said fees, I interpreted that as being those management costs into the future.
Yes.
No.
Your answer is no.
No.
Clarification. Commissioner, when you started out, you said you had $8.5 million worth of land for sale?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Is that number right?
And that's over the counter. That means it has gone out to public auction one time, and we did not receive the minimum bid. It is now over the counter for the first available buyer to come in.
And about how many acres is that?
Oh, I'd have to get that for the chair, ma'am. I'm sorry.
So that kind of answers my 3F question, right? Representative Erdahl?
Are we doing this sheet in order?
No. No, we're not.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Holston, I'll just try to get focused in more specific on a question. On monitoring or maintaining assets versus acquisition, a question that Representative Rukavina has thrown out quite a few times, and just provide you the opportunity to make a direct answer regarding the holdings that we have around Lake Vermilion now and his assertions that they are underdeveloped. And now with new acquisition there, how do you see the land that we have there being developed as compared with the new acquisitions?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, specifically to that question, you have the existing Sudan Underground Mine State Park. It has been his assertion, and I've heard him, and I've actually debated him on Almanac about this issue. He continues to talk about it as if it is a normal state park, one that you would normally think about, say, on the North Shore or Itasca, or even what the Greenleaf recreational area will eventually look like. Far from it. This is a historical mine. It was given to the state of Minnesota, and we were told to manage it as such. It is not really a state park as much as it is a historical museum. It doesn't have campgrounds. It doesn't have picnic areas. It doesn't have a beach. That's not the type of park it is. It's a historical park as part of our mission as the Department of Natural Resources, and part of the mission of the parks is to preserve that cultural identity. We provide tours of that, one of the first, if not the first, Madam Chair, you could probably tell me, iron mines of the state of Minnesota, both surface and below ground. Vermilion State Park and the development, the preliminary development that plan that we began talking with the local community about, is that traditional type state park full of the recreational amenities of trails, campgrounds, visitor center, water access site. Those are the types of amenities that will be furnished in this new park. That will be a, I mean, we're administratively going to manage the two together, and they'll be side by side, but the two are going to be vastly different in what they do for the community and the services and recreational opportunities that they provide.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Halston, and as one who has supported Lake Vermilion and, of course, Greenleaf, I just wanted to provide you with the opportunity to make that clarification. That's helpful.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Halston, we could talk a long time, but I'll try and restrict this to a few points. First off, you mentioned goals for land acquisition as being very large, and you also indicated that your appetite for land is very large. Who sets those goals and what feeds that appetite?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, the appetite comes from our passion about the work that we do and, quite frankly, the charge that we've been given by you, the legislature, to carry out those goals and objectives. The goals and objectives have been put together in a public process through the communication with local communities, local users, nonprofit organizations like Pheasants Forever, Ducks Unlimited, the groups that belong within the local communities. They come together and they help us define what those goals and our objectives are. They're big, they're aggressive, and they are long-term. They are not goals that we expect to achieve in 1, 5, or 10 years. These are goals and objectives that are laid out over a period of time using realistically the dollars that are available. But at the same time, as I said before, we are constantly looking at and reevaluating that land portfolio ownership that we have.
Okay, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, so where can I find these goals?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, you could find them online. You could ask us directly. We have WMA reports. We have parkland reports. We have myriads of reports that we are required to provide to the legislature annually. They could be embedded within those. Some of the data is contained within here into the goals. But I think one point that I think we need to be clear in, Department of Natural Resources, we're not... Our goals, as big as they may appear to be, we also recognize that in achieving the mission, achieving the goal, it's not going to be through land ownership. We can't acquire it all, nor do we want to. Our real goal is to get to a point where we're able to work with local communities in their land use decisions and help influence local landowners by providing them information and eventually resources to make those intimate land use decisions that they're going to have to make to achieve those water quantity, water quality, wildlife goals and objectives that are being set up.
Excuse me, just Commissioner, that means that you would work with people who own the land and work with them, your department, in the future?
Madam Chair, Representative, Madam Chair, we do that now with local units. We're our goals are to expand that and be more integrated within local communities and helping the decision makers within local communities, but also within a watershed influence local unit, local landowners, yes.
Back to you, Representative Harkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, that's the first commissioner that we've heard about anything but acquisitions this evening, and I appreciate that. You also mentioned hay fields and pastures, and I'm trying to figure out why it's important for the state of Minnesota to own hay fields and pastures when they could be held in private hands.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Ferguson, they're not pasture. These are, they may be native prairie grass. These are native grasslands that we have acquired and developed or redeveloped or maybe native prairie, and that's why we acquired them. We use that technique, utilizing the local landowners, to bring their cattle on, not every year, but maybe every other couple years, as a management technique to offset our management costs.
Just one final question, Madam Chair. Thank you so much. Commissioner Holston, as you're acquiring these properties throughout the state of Minnesota, and especially in my part of the world, southwest Minnesota, where we have good productive farmland, how much consideration do you give to your impact of this of these acquisitions and the actions that you take on the land after you've acquired it to the productive farmland in the area?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, one of the things that we're very cognizant of in our acquisition plans is we're not looking for that high valuable tillable land. What we're looking for is those wetland complexes, those marginal lands that farmers have where it may be seasonal issues, may not be every year, but areas that one that they have either restored themselves or areas that we find could be restorable, and they are in that marginal set. As I said earlier, down in your area of the woods, or prairie, or ag land, or cornfields, or bean fields, whatever we want to talk about today, we're managing about somewhere between 1% and 2% of that landscape, and over half of that is underwater down in your area of the state.
Commissioner, that's what you meant by underwater lands when you were talking about the ecology and the hydrology getting together, and you were talking about acquiring some land that was underwater?
Madam Chair, the acquisition or the ability to restore wetlands on that landscape, it is where those lands are and how those lands can best be prioritized in the acquisition. That's a part of what we are looking to do through that ecology and hydrology science, partnering with, again, Fish and Wildlife, to prioritize where those lands will be for the maximum benefit of wildlife habitat, water quality. Those are lands that will ultimately someday be underwater through wetland complexes or some other type of wetland restoration project.
Representative Tarkelson.
Thank you. Just an observation, really. As I drove through southern Minnesota this weekend, every wetland and lake that we passed was still frozen over with ice, and the ponds and farm fields were open and clear and filled with birds. I just thought it was very interesting that that all lands have a value at certain times and in certain conditions.
And Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, you are absolutely correct. And ones that we are, as we have unveiled a new proposal that we are evaluating called, they're going to be most soil units. It recognizes the value that agricultural land provides, and ones that we are going to be looking to work with those local landowners You're right. In the springtime, they're loaded with migrating waterfowl moving north. I just received a report at one of the units, or a unit in, I believe it's in Grant County. In the spring, it stores flood water. In the summer, it is farmed agriculturally. It was corn this year. The farmer had a hard time getting it off, as many farmers did this last fall. He wasn't able to. He got his corn off, but it remained in a very high stubble situation. We have now the spring conditions. In the spring, that unit is full of migrating waterfowl, providing them with the necessary nutrition and energy that they need to, from their migration north and their further migration further north. That is the type of things that we are going to be looking to use and cooperate with farmers more aggressively in the future.
And Representative Harkleson, I went out on Sunday too, and I went out in the field and the woods, and the ice was frozen, or on top of the water it was frozen, and I chopped it and with a big stick, and by 3 o'clock I had a whole flock of birds, big ones. Quack.
Sticks and choppers, obviously.
I do. I need to be home more. Representative Hawes.
Thank you. I'd just like to have a little clarity on the maintenance issue. When we do control burns, we're doing that to remove a non-native species. Years ago, if we had to graze animals on that same land, would have been considered a no-no, kind of counterproductive. Is that a practice now that has been made acceptable to rotate in a control burning with cattle grazing? That seems to be a conflict of biological sense to me, but please explain.
Madam Chair, I'll have Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Bogus?
Madam Chair and Representative, we're using more of those. We've used prescribed fire for a long time because the whole reason we had prairie in Minnesota, at least, was because it periodically burned without fire. Woody vegetation, trees and brush encroach on those prairies. But there was also pre-settlement a lot of grazing that occurred. It was more sporadic than typical agricultural grazing. As the Commissioner said earlier, we don't do it like a farmer would, where we're grazing it down all the time every year, but periodically, through some intensive short-term grazing, that provides a different type of disturbance that actually can be ecologically beneficial to those prairie plants. So it's different than a farmer pasturing cattle there, commercially and annually, but if introduced and then taken away and then reintroduced over a period of years, it can actually have a benefit to the prairie.
Thank you for that explanation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you again, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Holston, I apologize. I don't usually like to go back to the well, but as I said, this is a learning experience for me, and your answer to my last question just blew my mind. And I had to process it for a minute. So I guess I have a comment and another question. The comment is this. One of the things we hear about down here is no unfunded mandates. Particularly, we're hearing that a lot about schools. No more unfunded mandates. Loosen up the mandates. And the way I interpret your last question was the exact opposite of that. Give me unfunded mandates. Give me more land to manage, but don't give me more resources to do it. And that just seems strange to me, and maybe I'm learning, maybe I'm interpreting that wrong. So that's just a thought I had, and again, you can choose to comment on that. But let me ask, the question I really have for you is this, Commissioner Holston. You said you sign off on these Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council recommendations. If there's going to be no additional management dollars coming along with those recommendations that you sign off on, would it be reasonable for us, and particularly, I guess, Representative Wagenius's committee, to know which priorities are going to have to drop off the bottom of the list as far as land management goes in order for you to take those, that fixed pot of resources that you use to manage those resources, to manage these new resources that are coming in. Is it a reasonable expectation that along with your signing off on them, we might know so we can make an informed decision about which priorities are getting pushed off the bottom of the list? What is your thought on that?
Commissioner Holston.
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, Morgan, I'm sorry. I think the legislature, you have a 2-year time frame to look at the decisions you make. You make your decisions based upon a 1- and 2-year time frame. The decisions that the department is making have much more longer-term applications. When you ask us, do we have the resources to manage, we have the ability to manage the assets that we have available to us. We wouldn't have brought them into the system. When we brought them into the system, we have brought them into the system at that standard. And as I tried to impress upon you earlier, you can't take the standard approach that we do with other programs in a 1-year window or a 2-year window. Many of these lands can go for a long period of time without management. Can we absorb a lot more into the system when they come into the system in a quality state as we look to bring them in? We're able to do that. Long term, will we be able to at the resources available? Our management costs are going to go up. Quite frankly, many of the management costs are done through the Game and Fish Fund. It's through hunting and license fees. There is going to come a time. The fund is still in the black. We've been able to manage it for a long period of time without fee increases. But over time, if you're here for a number of terms, you will see a fee increase coming before the legislature to cover those management costs down the road. We will have needs to provide additional resources and time. But one of the things you need to understand is that the department, since you don't sit on the Environment Finance Budget Committee, in the last 10 years we've gone from 50% general fund to about 25% general fund. Our budgets have actually grown, and it's grown through user fees. We are becoming a user fee dominated agency, much like some of the other agencies in state government. But when that happens, license fees and user fees are going to continue to be the mechanism that we'll be looking to manage. So we will be coming in and asking for additional management resources in the future. We're not going to be able to come in and say it is for that parcel of land that we acquired 10 years ago and this parcel of land that we acquired 2 years ago. It just doesn't work that way.
Representative Wagenius.
Representative Morgan, you're standing at the well that needs some more work, I think.
Priming.
And we're not getting there. When you say we've lost the commissioner,
just a better profile.
When you say, Wagenius.
I understand we can buy a piece of land and let it go for a while, but we've been doing that for years. And what happens when you kind of let it go for a while? What happens is garlic mustard, wild parsnip, buckthorn, reed canary grass,
brush,
Pardon?
Brush.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that too. And so these can invade our good lands. They can invade our SNAs. And while the notion of putting cattle on some lands is great, we have a lot of lands you can't put cattle on. So, I mean, to be honest with this committee, you've got to say that you don't have enough money to manage the lands you have now, and there is no expectation in the near term you will have that. They're not there. I mean, I walk on lands that are crying to be burned because a once great prairie has sumac just covering it. And I check it out every summer, and there it is, still there, sumac's growing, prairie's disappearing. And this was native prairie. We have so little of it. So I think we've got to be a little more straightforward with this committee. Your general fund dollars are dropping. They're dropping substantially. Folks, we just cut DNR by, what was it, $5 million with tails. This is not one-time cuts. It's going to continue. So I think it's not realistic to say we can just wait. I mean, if we have lands in Representative Torkelson's area that have garlic mustard all over them, he's not going to appreciate that. He's not going to appreciate reed canary grass or buckthorn or wild parsnip. It's not the kind of thing you happen to like on your land, I think. And, oh, you do?
Representative Torkelson.
Never mind. Don't answer that question.
I'm going to answer that question very briefly. The CRP that I planted approximately 10 years ago, they required that I plant reed canary grass on it because at the time that was the cover of choice. And it just reveals how quickly things can and do change. And I'm in a sense agreeing with you because I do agree that these lands do need to be maintained. And our understanding of the value of certain practices changes over time, as we've talked about grazing and burning tonight. 20 years ago, as we were starting this effort to conserve land, we didn't understand the value of those sorts of practices. This is an ongoing practice, but it requires time and money to do it well.
Okay, Harry.
Representative Wiginius?
No, I think one of the things that, and I will have a bill in my committee that is asking for the same kind of long-term projections of management of WMAs, the same kind of thing that we did for in this committee and parks and trails, which has been immensely helpful. I can't tell you how helpful that has been in everything we do. We have a much better perspective of how to go forward with that information. We need it for the other kinds of things that are managed to.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner, thank you for being here. One part of the report, I'm sorry I had to step out, so maybe you covered it, but was actually quite favorable on the parks and trails part of that. And I was just, so congratulations for that, and the folks that work on that. Mr. Myers, I believe, took full credit for that.
He shouldn't.
But he just woke up.
Commissioner, I just have a couple questions. I don't know if you've kind of been following what we've been talking about in environmental finance and some of the folks that came in from Bowser, and it kind of links to you because some of their work, I think, is something that I hope that you take forward and consider doing, where they really were able to, through mapping and other means, to show their easements and other things as far as the lands that they have, and then kind of showed how the layering and how it fits, you know, with mapping and then the timing of it. And I think that would be really helpful for us as we talk about, you know, all acquisitions, and especially in parks and trails and et cetera, you know, the DNR properties. So I hope you consider that. And maybe you're already working on that. I hope I hope that's the case.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Lilly, we've got some of that information now. We can show you detailed layering of lands and priorities, particularly in southwestern Minnesota, region 4 of our state. We've got that capacity, and it can highlight and show you where things are happening and why we're going into those certain properties. We're working with Bowser on LCMR on the easement side with the developing of that system for monitoring. Our record system that we are developing ourselves to, with the resources provided by the legislature and from some internal realignments, so that you'll be able to access and go in and see intimate details about our ownership and the management plans. It'll all be there in a GIS form, and that's coming.
Good.
Yeah, Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner, I'm very happy to hear that, and I look forward to seeing some of that, maybe with the Chair Reginas' committee or others, you can bring some of that forward and see that as it develops. The chair here often talks about, she uses the word like cross-pollination, and one of the things that appeals to me as I sit on kind of both of these committees is that stuff that we acquire here or on other committees, you could maybe, whether it's wetland or something, you're protecting something, but you could somehow perhaps put a trail on there or an easement. You might be able to put a park bench or some way to cross-pollinate, using the chair's words, you know, to have these opportunities. So, and I don't know what they are. I mean, you know, you'd be surprised. I've seen, you know, just wonderful ponds as you travel or in different points, and you could certainly see a spot where they might decide to put up a bench. You know, if the, you know, you could arrange it or something so people could get out and enjoy the birds and the view. So I hope you consider that, and that's with the mapping, and perhaps you're doing some of that already. And I don't know if you have a comment or just want me to.
Madam Chair, Representative Lilly, we are doing exactly what you just said, and a lot of it. We have an initiative called our Gateway Initiative where we're using our park system as the system, but we're using all the resources and the programs that other divisions are doing and trying to bring more people into the park system and the trail system to show them high-quality recreational experience, the benefit of conservation, so we can expose a greater population of our public to the benefits of conservation. And we're doing a lot more of those very things that you're talking about. And some of that is just by coordinating and communicating inside and outside and designing those opportunities for people.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. And I just kind of want a final question, and I just, having you here, I just wonder how you feel about, you know, just the last few days we've had some interesting effect to some of your things that you're working on in your department. And I'm just going to list a couple, and I don't know if you want to comment on each of them or none of them, but like the Rukavina Amendment, perhaps, the veto of the trails initiatives. And then on the floor, we've had quite a bit of discussion about the acquisition. And I just know that myself, that people love trails and want them and need them and use them. And I was just surprised by the floor discussion and somewhat the veto. And just wondering if you have a comment on that. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, but in the interest of time, I will tell you, I am pressed on time, and so I am not going to comment on that.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner Holston. I'm glad to hear, in response to Representative Lilly's question, that you're really working hard to try and figure out outreach. But I got to say, you got to really hustle, because if you're going to become an agency that's totally dependent or more heavily dependent on fees, you're losing it in every generation in terms of participation. And as far as I can see, I just look at my own family, and the only ones who are continuing the hunting tradition is one family in greater Minnesota. And fishing, it's gone from about half to maybe at most a fourth of the next generation who participate ever in a typical season. And if you look at the demographics, I don't remember the exact percentage, but it's like 70% of the under 18 in a recent, I think it's a couple years old, were in the metro area. And if you don't find ways to make your land acquisition and your investments attractive to that next generation who has limited capacity, many of them, in terms of getting out to greater Minnesota where your acquisitions are, it's going to be hard to sustain the kind of both the financial wherewithal that you're going to need to keep operating, but also the political. And the kinds of things that are being offered are, it looks to me, are mostly attractive to people. It's the same things that were attractive to people, 30, 40 years ago. I know that the state parks have started doing geocaching, but I don't see kind of the new promotions, particularly the state parks have done better, but in terms of the other components of our land holdings, I don't see those reaching out to kind of the new interest of younger people, and I really think we're going to have to see some major changes to even just keep what we've currently got going.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, you have pretty much given the speech that I gave the agency 4 years ago. You are absolutely right. We are painfully aware of the recreational trends. We are painfully aware of the demographic shifts. If you watch some of our budget presentations, we talk about it very openly. It is embedded within our budget documents. It's embedded within our policy decisions. It is something that we have brought to the legislature, and unfortunately, some of those haven't been funded. Our outreach opportunities to minority communities. Not funded. And we have dedicated money sitting in the accounts. We are painfully aware and continually exploring and pushing the boundaries to do that outreach, both retention and recruitment into not just hunting and fishing, but bringing them and exposing them to conservation through our park system, through our trail system, through hunting and fishing. Through any avenue that we can, we are trying to develop those programs and those outreach programs. But it is because we see the problem. We know what the demographics are, and they're bad.
Well, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Commissioner Wellen. Just one follow-up. I think that you have to bring that conservation ethic into their backyard. Mm-hmm. And I think that means balancing land acquisition across the state and having more of it, quite honestly, and where people can see it, they can bike to it. They're not going to get in a car and drive to it necessarily. And I think it's going to take a total revisioning of how we serve the public to make that happen. And I think we're overdue for doing it. And I appreciate your having pushed the envelope as much as you have.
And Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I'm just so happy to hear you say that, because that's why we partnered with the University of Minnesota in trying to help the Bell Museum come forward, because we saw that as, again, a regional opportunity embedded within a community. We reached out to the university and were part of that for a while. It's fallen off their map, but it's an opportunity that we saw and worked intimately with them. And we are very interested, and that's why we took the approach of taking our park system and our trail system and the two management units, and we brought them together for that very reason, so that we can connect communities to our parks through our trail systems. Our grant programs are designed to connect at a local unit of government those communities to the state trail system, those communities to regional trail systems, so that we can develop and do that type of education and that type of outreach through that mechanism. Is it the answer? No, but it's one, and we are going to continue to work on those issues.
Representative Guinness. kind of push back a little bit on the outdoor thing. I think the younger generation and the older generation walk a lot more. I mean, there, or at least there are a lot more walkers, but those don't show up in your statistics, and a lot more biking. I mean, just, you know, regular biking. And that's not statistics that you bring to our committee. We're still in an old paradigm, and visiting this new paradigm, I mean, I have kids and grandkids that spend enormous amounts of time outdoors, and even though I tried to teach them how to fish when they were little, I really did, guys, I really did, because I did it when I was a kid. I know how to do all that stuff. It didn't take, but they spend an enormous amount of time outdoors doing other things. So I just think we need to go where people are, not try to tell them where they should be.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Rodriguez brings out a fabulous point, and how the state has approached it, or the legislature has approached it, is to tier it. We have the state park system, we have the county system, we have the metropolitan system, and the local system. It's a tiered approach through recreation, through, and that's how you've approached it, through your, through budget, through bonding. We're managing the state system. You have provided resources to the county and regional systems and to the local units of government systems. It's an interconnected system from a funding stream. All of it being important, one not being more than the other. We just happen at the DNR to monitor the state system and manage the state system that you've asked us to manage. To the point of walking and biking, you know, a lot of our resources, a lot of our tracking mechanisms are through some type of licensing or some type of fee system. Walking and hiking and biking doesn't have that. We can provide you very specific data about
everybody.
Who's snowmobiling, who's ATVing, who's going into our park systems, who's buying canoes, kayaks. We've got all that stuff. I can't tell you very well. It's generic data on biking and hiking. I just don't have access to that kind of really intimate data system because they're not tracked.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Chair. I believe that Mr. Noble, did you have a question or comment?
At some point.
Okay. That's, he was signaling.
Any other questions, Commissioner? Thank you so much. You've
thank you.
Given us more than time that we asked for. There's question number 5 and 6. If we decide to do some summer research on all aspects of PILT, and if we do some summer research and attempt to establish some kind of policy concerning how wetland and carbon credits are doing, can we expect cooperation and sharing of information with your agency?
No. Sure, of course you can. That's public information, and we are here to serve your interests. We are.
We'll get
the questions you have.
I'll get to do it.
Maybe I didn't do a great job of answering each one of your intimate questions, and I will be happy to come by and share more data. Quite frankly, I'd love to spend some summertime with some of you members.
I want to Greenlee.
Show. Yeah, we've spent some time out there, not with you personally, Representative Erdahl, but we brought our management team. We brought our management team out there this summer to talk about what the future holds for units like Greenleaf, and use that as the example. You have a very precious system out there, and the opportunities that I can't explain to you here. You really need to go out and see it, and look at it, and feel it, and you'll start to see some of the things that we're really talking about, and dispel some of the myths that are presented through people.
Thank you very much. Mr. Jaski. Welcome.
Yeah, Madam Chair, John Jaski, Director of Board of Water and Soil Resources, and I looked over your questions, and it looks like just the 1A and 1B are the two that were most relevant to what you were interested in terms of the way we manage our conservation easements.
But who can tell what else might come up?
I'll be prepared as best I can.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, the report didn't have a lot of details in it about our conservation easements. It basically said that we have a programmatic, systematic approach, and that's because it's incorporated into a state statute, the Reinvested Minnesota Statute 103F.515, which has rules and a chapter of rule as well, so we have to follow those criteria very carefully. It's also true that they're very different, that the easements we're pursuing than the ones that maybe the DNR is pursuing for a whole variety of reasons. Ours are very many. We have 5,000 easements. That's a lot. They average somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 or 50 acres. That's an average. Of course, they range much smaller and larger than that. We select the sites through a process, what we call a sign-up, which is really an RFP for sites that we're looking to restore wetlands on or restore riparian buffers. So we're targeting, you know, many hundreds, if not thousands, of possible sites, and then we select those that are the highest scoring. The score sheet that we use to rank those looks at wildlife habitat principally, also water quality, and to some extent flood attenuation, and we rank those projects, so the opportunities that we're looking at, the restorations accordingly, and select those that have come to the top of the list based on the amount of funding we have available, and that happens depending on where the funding source comes from and how much we get. So that's the maybe a little bit of a contrast. As the commissioner noted, we have a couple things in common. One is that we use a database approach. We've had that for a long time. We, thanks to the LCCMR, gave us some funding to make it more modern, to put it actually into a GIS format with the ability to show maps and actually put parts of it online for people to actually see where these easements are. So we appreciate that. That's been completed. We also, you know, as was mentioned by Representative Lilly, you know, I've got some work mostly finished but still not completely done with the LCCMR to come up with the scientific underpinnings to select the most cost-effective and ecologically beneficial sites on the landscape, because again, we have a very, very large number of possible sites to pick from. Minnesota has about half of its remaining wetlands in place, so there's 10 million acres that once were there that aren't there. Now we aren't going to get all of those back. We can't get all those back. We shouldn't, but it allows us to pick from a large possible list of sites, and we work with willing landowners to accomplish that. So that's kind of a general response to question 1A. I'll keep going if you'd like, but the second...
Are there any questions before it goes on? Please continue.
Okay, yeah. And then, Madam Chair, members, on question 1B, and the DNR obviously has to respond to half of this potentially, but as the commissioner noted, they have easements that are very unique for a variety of reasons, some of which may be as simple as pure access, some of which are for, you know, rounding out little parts of property. Ours are very homogeneous. We are the RIM program seeking out marginal degraded landscapes on ag land in most of the cases, where we restore a wetland or restore riparian buffers. We're doing restoration easements. The DNR, I think they would probably say the bulk of theirs are protection easements or access easements. So they're very different kinds of landscapes that we're targeting in most of those cases. Obviously, in certain situations, we pursue a partnership with DNR to try and find landscapes that will supplement their wildlife management areas. We look for blocks of land easements that sometimes are compatible or adjacent to these WMAs or even the federal Fish and Wildlife System. We work with them to find lands that maybe aren't for sale that could be kept in private ownership but still provide conservation. So we are very focused on a singular type of easement, and I think that's why it's in some ways easier to be systematic the way we have our system set up in our program, you know, guided by these statutes and rules. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll stand for any questions or comments.
Questions, comments? Representative Hausman.
A comment. I'm just a fan. I think we are so fortunate to have Mr. Jasky doing what he does. And as someone who's had to work with their staff, it's just an incredible joy to have the kind of cooperation and partnership.
I think that's evident by the form of the questions that were in the comments that were made before about how it seems like your success is because you drink coffee around the kitchen table with people that you deal with.
Well, yeah, Madam Chair, let me just put on a couple of things, too. You know, it's sort of the one point in here about we do have an appropriation to monitor our easements. You know, we're challenged in that regard, too, in that, you know, that was cut in half once, and I'm likely to see it cut again this year to some extent, not that amount, I don't believe. You know, the legislative auditor reviews our programs across the board on about every three-year basis. So one of the things they look at are our easement programs, and the audit, the most recent one that was completed, they pointed out that we weren't fulfilling all of our obligations to do that monitoring and all of the easements that we had, and so we took some efforts to do that. Now, we're fortunate to find some federal money to pull that off because there really wasn't any state money around to do that. So we took on that issue. Now, hopefully we aren't finding some hole that someplace else, but certainly we do have a systematic approach because the local agents, the local soil and water districts, are the ones that, like you say, and I'm sure work with landowners, and they do the inspections. As Representative Torkelson noted, you know, there are specifications in place for what kinds of plant communities are put on the landscape. We've had a program that has a policy that our board enacted, I think, in 1997 or 98, that said we would not accept any non-native plant species in our projects, which was ahead of the federal government. They hadn't gotten to that point yet, Representative Torkelson. So you had CRP, which is a different situation on your property. I think we've, in the case where we work with the federal government, which is a lot of our projects, we, you know, use our standard as the minimum, and they've accepted that. So I think that's been helpful. But they bring a good bit of funding to the equation, too. We want to make sure we can continue using their funding to supplement Minnesota's funding. So a couple more comments.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Jasky, you had mentioned that you've been able, with LCCMR funds, to be able to actually create a database and do some mapping of your holdings and easements. Do you believe that the current technology that you're using is scalable so that we could potentially use that same approach to map and record existing ownership opportunities in other agencies? I know it was designed for one purpose. My question is, could it serve to scale up and have other properties put in as an overall inventory?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I believe that is what is happening with that LCCMR grant. As the Commissioner may have alluded to, the grant was made in kind of two pieces to each of our agencies. We had, you know, some things done more completely at the time, but because we had a narrower focus, it was easier to do that. They've got a much broader focus, and so we were using the same underpinnings of that database is absolutely correct. And obviously getting the data into it is another piece of work, and that's something that, you know, we had already in place in this more, I guess, ancient database, but they're looking to fill theirs up too, and so we will have a compatible, similar system in the end.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jasky.
Thank you.
Mr. Yonker and Mr. Noble, do you have any response to the response?
Madam Chair, Jim Nobles, Legislative Auditor, I'd like to make just two quick responses, and I think it might have been more appropriate for me to make them with the Commissioner here, but I will go ahead and make them anyway. I think the Commissioner may have unintentionally misstated what we were bringing forth to you as our assessment of unmet needs, which is on page 46. I think there was an implication that, for example, on the forestry assessment of needs in roads and bridges, that was ours. That's actually the department's assessment, which brings me to the point I really want to make, and that is, I think one of the values of this report and sometimes of other reports that we do is that we bring forth information that is not as filtered as the information you get from commissioners, because we go deep into departments and hear from the professionals their assessments of what their situations are, and that's what this table is. This is an assessment of the professionals in DNR of what their needs are. This is what, frankly, the commissioner had some difficulty with in reviewing this report, that we were bringing forth to you and to the public and others an assessment that is in the department. And so I guess what I would suggest to you, that it's possible that you might get more direct and definitive answers on some of these questions if you too went not aside from the commissioner, because I know commissioners are important and that there's a certain protocol that needs to be respected in terms of dealing with the heads of departments. But I think in this area and maybe in others, it would be helpful if you heard more from the professionals in the department, because these really are very complex programs that have a scientific basis. And there are within the department people who are professionals who spent years and have expertise in these programs. So I did want to say that while the commissioner was here. We had this conversation, he and I, over the course of this evaluation. I certainly respect his position, but again, what you see in front of you is an assessment of the professionals within the Department of Natural Resources of what they feel their unmet needs are. Second point I want to make is that, excuse me, Madam Chair.
Was it in this format?
The assessments, Madam Chair, that we got?
Yeah. Was Table 3.2 directly from DNR?
It is from a variety of sources. They're footnoted, but the one in particular that he referenced concerning roads and bridges in the forestry is again, their assessment. But, you know, what we wanted to do with this report was not only have you see this information, but for this to be a part of the conversation, because, again, as the commissioner said, there are large appetites within the department. The people who run these programs feel passionately about them. And maybe these are unrealistic expectations and needs. Certainly, you have to apply the reality of the funds that you have. But at least you ought to have this information as part of the conversation. It's not that you have to accept it, that you have to fund it, but that it simply ought to be a part of the conversation. The other point I wanted to make is that, and it's in reference to Representative David's point, I guarantee you we do not expect legislators or anybody else to necessarily agree with our recommendations. We often hear differences of opinion to our recommendations, and we're very comfortable with that. You know, what we are really in the business of doing is finding facts. And I'm quite happy to say that I have not found people to differ with our facts or to dispute them. But our recommendations come from a certain perspective, and we realize there are many other perspectives, particularly the perspective of the elected representatives of the people, you. And we don't expect that you will simply take our recommendations and adopt them. You live in a much more complex world, and you do have to take into consideration the concerns of your constituents and interest groups and many other people. But we are asked to make recommendations. We are asked to give our judgment as nonpartisan professionals what we think ought to be done. But there are clearly other approaches and ideas that should be brought forth. So the suggestion that we, as an organization, are expecting you to adopt and agencies to simply automatically comply with our recommendations is a false representation of our view of who we are. So I'm sorry Representative Davids isn't here to hear that, but I don't know where exactly he got the idea that we promulgate the concept that agencies are expected to comply with or you to adopt our recommendations simply because we put them forth. We put them forth for your discussion and consideration, and we appreciate that we are given that consideration.
Mm-hmm. And Auditor Nobles, I think that was mm-hmm. concluded as a result of the wording of question number 7, and I think we have to reword number 7 in the future.
Thank you.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Noble, Commissioner Holston referenced one of your points about, and I'm sorry I don't have it in front of me, the question, but something to the effect that it appears that the department, that the DNR cannot maintain its land or whatever. Was that being posed as a question or a statement by you?
Well, let me just be clear about what we said. We said, from, again, the information we obtained from many sources, that it appears from the data that the department puts together that they say they do not have the resources they need to manage the land that they have. But again, our point was much more work needs to be done by DNR. There were some areas, for example, where they had done quite a good job of assessing their needs. They did that, I might add, in response to a legislative requirement on parks and trails. But in other areas, they're woefully lacking in that kind of assessment. So we could not definitively say from data that they have available or from data we might generate ourselves exactly what the level of gap is between their current land holdings and their need to not only develop but maintain those. But it clearly appeared to us that from the department's own assessments that they were lacking.
Representative Wiginius.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just feel a need to, at this point, say that I found your facts and recommendations super helpful. Super, super helpful.
Thank you.
Mr. Yonker, anything to respond to?
Well, one clarification, Madam Chair, John Yonker from the Legislative Auditor's Office. One thing I would just emphasize is you can manage the lands, or DNR can manage the size, is you can manage the lands, or DNR can manage the lands with whatever funds they're given. But it's a function of can they manage and maintain the lands, and what condition are they maintaining the lands in? And in some cases, they don't have good information on what the condition of those lands are, like in the area of wildlife management areas. They also need to do work to try to identify what their needs are. And we would be the first people to say, and we say it in the report, that you need to be careful about what are your needs and what are your wants. And the legislature, once DNR does a long, if you're going to require them to do a long-range budget analysis, as we've recommended, you're going to want to take a look at how did they define their needs. And you're going to want to get into that report. But we really think that the solution here to give you more information so you can balance the issue of acquisitions versus maintenance of existing lands is to get these long-range budget analyses from DNR. And that's what Representative Wiginius's bill proposes to do.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for providing us with a very interesting evening. Mr. Ongaro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John Ongaro, Director of Intergovernmental Relations with St. Louis County. I do have a handout that I have for the committee, which gets to the point of Representative Hausman's question rather directly.
Okay.
First of all, Madam Chair and members, from the county perspective, we are very happy to have this study done, especially from the PILT perspective, to which I'll be speaking tonight. And all the good things that were in the report, we did find one issue that unfortunately I think is creating somewhat of a perception problem for counties, and that's what I would like to focus on this evening. The handout that's before you specifically quotes from the legislative auditor's report that Minnesota counties are getting, I think it's 2/3, not 64%, more from PILT payments, county town taxes, than if the land were on the property tax rolls. And counties, at least St. Louis County, that our assessor had a chance to review this, feels that that really isn't true because of various reasons, trying to boil it down to at least three. And just for the point of clarification, I want to make sure that everybody realizes that what the legislative auditor is referring to here are not all the PILT lands. It's just the acquired acre lands. So we're not talking about the county-administered lands. We're not talking about the DNR-administered lands. We're just talking about the acquired acre lands, which are the 0.75% of market value lands, lands that, for example, would be like state parks, lands that were on the tax rolls when the DNR purchased them, in other words. If you look at the first graph on the next page, you see a history of land.
Excuse me.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Ongaro, slow down a little bit now. You're not talking about county lands. You're talking about just one kind of DNR land, and that's parkland?
Of the three major types of PILT payments, the major PILT payment that is focused on here is the acquired acre lands.
That are focused in the auditor's report, you mean?
Specifically, when the statement was made in the report that Minnesota counties are getting 2/3 more from PILT payments than if the lands were on the property tax rolls, the only PILT payment that counties receive that's based on a market value is the acquired acre payment, 0.75% on market value. So, although in hindsight, the way the land values went this past decade, I think those other two forms of PILT payments, the county administered lands and the DNR lands, we could have received more money from those than the implicit price deflator, in other words, the inflation index that we received on those lands. But obviously, the law says those lands are only to get an inflation adjustment, and so we're not really trying to mix those lands with this. Again, the legislative auditor was focusing on only the acquired acres lands, and that's what we would like to focus on this evening as well. So if you turn the page, you see a history of land values in St. Louis County, all the way back to 1856 when the county began to present day. Obviously, suddenly in the year 2000, after roughly 14 decades, you see a substantial increase. And if you turn to the next page, that increase shows up here. In other words, it took 143 years to get land values to roughly $1.7 billion in St. Louis County. And then in one decade, suddenly those lands happened to triple in value. So we went from $1.7 billion that took 15 or 14 decades to get to that, suddenly you had a tripling of the land values in St. Louis County. And the year 2005, you see, that was when the assessors actually went out to assess those 0.75% lands, those acquired acre lands. So obviously there was a big jump in PILT payments for not only St. Louis County, but I think this was in the report. It pretty much showed that this was pretty much the case throughout the state, that lands literally doubled in value in those first 5 years of this past decade. But what's interesting is that you see already in 2007, obviously 2008, 2009, a leveling off of those big increase in values, and I think that's what the committee should really focus on more than anything is that what occurred over this past decade, for lack of any better term, was really something which we'll probably never ever experience again in our lifetimes, because it was a real estate bubble, let's face it, and that real estate bubble has broken, and we're no longer able to use our homes and the equity in our homes and our land as literally ATM machines, which some people were able to do. That's over. So it was a lot of that was based on a false economy. As we know, one in four mortgages are underwater today nationally, and we're really never going to see the kind of hyperinflated prices that we witnessed over this last decade. So the long and short of it is people should be very careful to when they draw conclusions about the land prices that occurred during this real estate bubble, because of the hyperinflation that occurred. For example, if their land values for just these acquired acres were two-thirds higher during the boom, the question might be asked, well, could they be 64% lower during a bust? And the only way you know is looking at history, and I think the charts and graphs that you have in front of you show that what we had occur over this past decade was something that really is only going to happen once, hopefully, every at least 153 years, no more often than that anyways. A second reason for which we think that the two-thirds figure is erroneous is if you look at the next page. This came right from our assessor's office, the highlighting yellow on the top. What that shows is that there are approximately, in St. Louis County anyways, 15 cities that do have acquired acre lands within them. Specifically in the report, on page 67 of the report, the legislative auditor is quoted as saying, "We excluded cities under the assumption that most natural resource lands is in towns and unorganized territories." But what you see here are 15 cities in St. Louis County that do have PILT acquired acre lands in them, and essentially what my assessor did was add up the local rate and the county rate together. That would be like the township and the county rate together, and compared those to the PILT rate, all highlighted in yellow there, and you can see anywhere from 38% to 128% higher the lands that are taxed on an ad valorem basis actually pay more than PILT. So that kind of flies in the face of what the legislative auditor is saying, that you know, the PILT lands are paying two-thirds more than land that's on an ad valorem basis. And we're saying that by adding cities, which obviously the legislative auditor made a professional judgment to not include those, we're saying that at least in our county, and from what I hear from other counties, there are substantial PILT lands within cities too in their counties. So that could substantially help reduce the rate. How much? Well, in St. Louis County, for example, there are 509 parcels in St. Louis County where the PILT rate is less than the county local rate by a weighted average of 17.12%. There are 459 parcels where the PILT rate is greater than the county local rate by a weighted average of 4.87%. So in the report, legislative auditor said St. Louis County, for example, somewhere between 0 and 5% more, PILT pays more than if the land were on an ad valorem basis. My assessor is saying when you include cities, the pilt lands that are in cities, suddenly just the opposite occurs. Those pilt pays approximately 0 to 5% more. Pilt pays 0 to 5% less than if those lands were on a ad valorem basis. So is that substantial? Well, I mean, clearly in one county anyways, just the opposite conclusion of what the legislative auditor arrived at is the case. But again, it helps explain some of that disparity when you see that two-thirds higher. Obviously, when you include pilt lands that are located within cities, acquired acre pilt lands located within cities, suddenly that helps level the playing field somewhat. That disparity is not as high as two-thirds anymore. And that's, I think, worth looking much more closely at. Finally, my assessor felt that there's kind of an apples-to-oranges comparison, and that's the purpose of that rather interesting slide there that says no matter how you slice it, these apples don't add up. And if you envision those apples, in St. Louis County's case anyways, equaling 218 apples, because that's the number of unique taxing authorities St. Louis County has within its boundaries. So in order to arrive at a aggregated rate, a quote right from the legislative auditor's report, it said on page 67, a footnote, we aggregated property tax revenues and net tax capacities for all towns and unorganized territory to calculate an overall county-town rate for each county. So because there are 218 unique taxing authorities in St. Louis County, they somehow took all 218, came up with an average number for each of those tax extension rates, and said that equals three, you know, compared to the what Pilt pays, which would be that orange, 0.75%, and then that was how they decided with whether that was tax extension rate was above the Pilt payment, which would be 0.75%, or below that. That's how they arrived at that. And to try and aggregate what the average tax extension rate is for all 218 unique taxing authorities and then apply that one number against the 0.75% of market value, which Pilt pays, is far too overgeneralized and oversimplified. To be meaningful, each and every unique taxing authority that contains Pilt has their own tax rate, and it is only that tax rate that should be compared to what Pilt pays. And that is the true apples-to-apples comparison, and that's what we're trying to demonstrate here, that a true apples-to-apples comparison was not made. Were they somewhat in the ballpark? Probably. But again, it, from a perception standpoint, it gives counties you policymakers, the perception that counties are getting overpaid by their Pilt payments. And I think, in conclusion, a much fairer way to look at this would be to, in the report, the legislative auditor said, if you just went on a straight inflation comparison between what counties have received in Pilt payments going back to 1979, 1980, when the program started, to today, it's roughly 30% higher payment that counties are getting overall from Pilt. Based on inflation rather than just looking at one of the Pilt payments, which is acquired acres, which obviously this past decade, you know, it was unreal. It was based on a false economy, and those values that we were able to run up on those lands, hopefully they're going to hold. Are they going to continue to grow as they have? Not realistically. I think a much fairer comparison would be, as earlier in the report, that the legislative auditor used that comparison of the inflation rate, in this case the implicit price deflator, over those roughly three decades and what counties actually received. And that was 30% above the implicit price deflator, which, again, when you consider what happened this last decade. Take that out, we were probably below inflation. In fact, I know we were below inflation at that point. But when you include the last decade, obviously things got a little bit skewed. But my message to you this evening is I don't think we're going to see those kind of disparities continue into the future. So those that are concerned about PILT payments going up, you know, at the rate they were going up this past decade, my assessor anyway says that's not likely to happen.
So, Mr. Ungaro, you and your assessor wants to be part of a summer research project if we do one?
Madam Chair, only if it's in Hermantown.
How about Pike Lake?
Well, that would be fine.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's always helpful when I read through that legislative auditor, footnote, so we're able to see their source of their information. What is the source of this graph?
The long run from 1856 on.
What is it?
That's from our St. Louis County Assessor's Office.
And the reason I ask is I don't know which committee it was, but Representative Rukavina has been pretty clearly giving us a different kind of point of view than this dramatically rising line in the year 2010. He's talking about people taking properties off the market because they can't sell them for half of what they thought.
Well, Madam Chair,
it's such a different picture than this sharp.
Well, Madam Chair,
Mr. Ungaro,
and Representative Hausman, I do think that if you look at that next graph, the last 3 years, 2007 through 2009, you see a leveling off of those land values, and I think that shows that the rate of increase that was so steep, averaging 20% a year in the first half of the decade, is no longer occurring, and that those land values have leveled out. But I believe that, you know, there are some areas of the county, obviously, that the land values probably have been falling, and that might be what Representative Rukavina is referring to. I know that if you look at his district specifically, take out the lakeshore, and you know, you're going to have some land that's clearly been falling. This is all of St. Louis County, including the Duluth area. So,
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, sir, just I agree with you that we should be comparing apples to apples. I just want to make sure that we're comparing apples to apples with your definition of cities and towns and mine. I mean, in my area, a town has city blocks and houses and people living in them. And in driving up north in your area, sometimes I'll come to, you know, city limits of, you know, whatever, and I'll drive a few miles before I hit a town, and so are your towns. You know, they're obviously containing a lot of what we would consider rural areas, but they're within your city limits. Is that included in your PILT definition then?
Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl, definitely, you know, it's within the city limits that we do have PILT lands that are considered acquired acre PILT lands. So 15 cities in St. Louis County is what the assessor gave me.
Okay.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And sir, well, then essentially, it's not exactly apples to apples. I mean, your cities and my cities are a little bit different. And I think we'll get around to that. Mr. Noble's like to comment as well.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Ungaro, I'm looking at your detailed table, and it looks to me, if I look at the right two columns, that you're saying that within St. Louis County, there were 509 parcels where the PILT was less than the tax bill that would otherwise have been paid, and there were 459 parcels in which the PILT payment was greater than the tax paid. Is that a correct assumption of those two charts, columns?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, is correct. Yes.
And Mr. Ungaro, in order to be an informed person about whether or not the state auditor's assertion that we are over or underpaying. It would be really useful if you could get us the dollar numbers, because it looks like, you know, it's kind of half and half, but we don't have any information about the net to St. Louis County, and I think that would be very useful, and I bet your assessor could crank that out for us, and I'd love to get it.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I will get those numbers for you.
Fantastic. I mean, to me, the goal should be that if you have 1,000 pieces parcels in a county, they should all be treated about the same, and that shouldn't be one township or one city wins or one loses. It should be more comparable, but I'd love to know what the net result is here on both of those columns. That'd be great.
Mr. Nobles, Mr. Yonker, and Mr. Angaro, is this an orange? It looks like a tomato to me.
It's an orange.
Depends on how you slice it. Madam Chair.
I don't think oranges have those little stars.
Madam
Mr.
Chair.
Mr. Nobles.
Let's take just one step back, and then Mr. Yonker can get into some of the details. Let us remind you what we were trying to do. We were trying to figure out what is TILT supposed to accomplish. And we had some trouble with that because it's not real clear in the law. And we said quite explicitly it was not clear in the law whether or not it's to pay for the cost of services that exist in a locale where state land has been acquired or state-owned land, or is it to replace the taxes that have been lost. And so we tried various approaches, and probably most people think of it in terms of it's replacing taxes that would have been there. So we did an aggregate kind of analysis and recognized, and I think we've said quite explicitly, that you can take the conclusion that we have here, and we do not say anybody's being overpaid or underpaid. We simply present the facts from the analysis, and said quite explicitly, as is true with any aggregation of data, you can find specific pieces of data that are an exception to the average. And so I'm not surprised that you can pick out parcels that can be demonstrated to be an exception to the general statement. So I just think we need to keep that in context, and I think that the comment about are we picking out in what was presented to you just those parcels that prove a point, I think does need to be kept in mind. Mr. Yonker.
Mr. Yonker.
Madam Chair, I would just add a few points to that. First of all, the finding that TILT is on newly acquired land is 64% higher than the taxes it replaced. That doesn't apply to all acquired land. As I explained when I presented it in front of the two committees, it applies to non-hunting land. Comparison would be different if you looked at hunting land. Remember, hunting land is distributed, that TILT is distributed to counties, towns, and school districts. The non-hunting land is only distributed to counties and towns. Now, that brings up another point. If it's only being distributed to counties and towns, why aren't cities getting it in those rare exceptions? And, you know, just a quick aggregation or adding up of the figures here, it looked like maybe 2-3% of the acres in St. Louis County that were receiving TILT were in cities. And we said in the report there are probably some cities where state land is, but they don't get any TILT. So, you know, I'm not sure what the right comparison is when you're paying out TILT and the cities have some very high tax rates, but you don't give TILT to the cities. It's only going to the counties and the towns. And another point we made in the presentation was towns are getting a very small slice of that. They're only getting about 2.5% on average. Who's getting the lion's share? The counties are. So, you know, we could do another analysis that we just looked at what the county share was of TILT and what the taxes were that were being replaced. And I can guarantee you that on an average basis across the state,
that number of 64% is probably going to be at least that high or higher, because the counties are the main beneficiaries here. Another point to make here, and it's my last point, is that part of that 64% is not just the comparison of the tax rates, but we were talking about newly acquired property. So let's say DNR goes out and acquires a property and pays $100,000 for it. What was it on the tax? What was it assessed for on the tax rolls? Well, you got to adjust using the sales ratio, what's called the sales ratio, and it reflects the fact that property is generally underassessed, not always, but generally underassessed compared to what the market value is. So maybe that property was only on the tax rolls at $80,000. So the taxes paid on it would be the county town tax rate times the $80,000, whereas the PILT is 0.75% times the $100,000. So you can get part of that difference, that 64% difference on newly acquired non-hunting land, is going to come from the sales ratio and from the fact that property is generally underassessed. So it doesn't surprise me that you would find some parcels in which, in any county, in which the PILT might be less than the taxes paid. There are going to be counties in which that's true on an average basis, but most counties would not be in that category.
And Mr. Yonker, does the county have to share with the township? Is that why there's such a difference? Or is there a criteria by which the township receives their money separate from the county?
The money initially, Madam Chair, the money initially goes to, say, the county treasurer, and state law says how much of that money should go to the townships and how much should go to the counties. And sometimes there's specific direction for certain types of land as to what it's to go for. In the case of acquired non-hunting land, the townships, as I explained when we presented the report, initially $3 per acre was paid in PILT, and the townships got 30 cents. That's been inflated up to $5.11 and 51 cents for the townships out of that 5.11. But the total PILT is often a lot more than 5.11. In fact, it averages around $20 an acre statewide for that type of land, because we're now paying based on valuation, not based on a flat figure per acre in those counties where the valuation comes out with a higher figure. And the townships still get 51 cents per acre, even though you might be paying $20 or $30 or $40 per acre overall. So it's the townships that are not getting their fair share in general on average, and the counties are getting more than their fair share on average, but not in every specific county, not for every specific parcel.
And the counties aren't obligated to share their additional money that they get on valuation with the township.
Madam Chair, that
beyond the 51 cents.
Madam Chair, that's correct. The law is very specific about what townships get, and it's 51. For that type of land, it would be, for the most recent year, 2009, it would have been 51 cents per acre.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any additional comments about the land report? Mr. Angaro.
I would just like to comment on the townships and why perhaps they are limited in the amount of funding they would get. Keep in mind that this is an in-lieu payment, and therefore the funding should go to help pay for the services to that level of government that's actually providing most of the services to those lands. And I think if you look at the kind of lands that we're talking about, clearly the unit of government that is providing the most services to those lands is the county government, and that is why counties are receiving the lion's share of that funding. So I just want to make sure that members realize that.
Thank you. Any other public testimony on the lands report? Thank you. Members of the committee, looking at the sheet of questions, if there's any question that you would like further discussion or comment or written answer to, will you please let me know, and I will follow up, and I will rewrite number 7 so it's
please
not offensive to Representative Davids and anyone, but so that we get an answer of whether the DNR has a problem with any of them, any of the recommendations. Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, I would like to move adoption of the minutes of our 47th meeting from March 17 as submitted.
Any objections? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. The minutes are adopted as printed. Members, we have another meeting. I would like to start before 8:30. I would like to start at 8:10. On Wednesday.
In the morning.
In the morning. Yeah, in the morning. They're telling us mornings are good for meetings.
We'll come
and
back in the night.
The possibility exists that we will try to fit one other meeting in this week. I don't know if that's going to be possible with conflicts or not, but I'm going to try.
You can always hold.
We will let you know. Agenda is some bills and stuff. I don't have it with me, Representative Hausman. 8:10. This meeting is adjourned.